Welcome to the F3 podcast. I'm Adam Stattmiller, and one of your co-hosts here. We are down one of the F3 members, Harry Wilson, not here today, but Chris, you're here. He's off. When he's not with us, he's off learning stuff. Yep. That's what I love. So good. How you doing, bro?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
I'm trying to jog, so I'm tired.
We used to jog together. You have a famous story. We used to run together, and what did I say? You were really good.
No, well, I was running a lot, and you were good. You ran well.
I ran okay, but there was a season. Remember, I said something like, "I'm going to kick your butt." Or how did it go?
No, we were running Sunset Cliffs.
And yes,
we ran down and then back, and we had to go up it's Hill Street and
a big hill.
Yeah, and so about a quarter mile away, you say, I'm ticked, and you just take off running.
I was mad because you were going a little faster than me. I think you were keeping that pace. Yeah,
yeah. You used to be competitive, not anymore.
No.
Anyways,
I'm way less competitive than you are.
It became my objective to reel you back in, and so I just followed you, tried to, and
then you paced me out.
Up that hill, I passed you as fast as I could. As I passed you, I said, "You still tick?" And I think you started walking after that.
You broke me. You broke me. Oh, right on.
Anyway, so I'm a little tired, but I'm doing well.
Yeah, good, man. Well, look, hey, we are going to have a conversation about a new series that I've begun this week called The Son of Anarchy, and it is about King David and basically the relationship of a father and a son, and how the family model goes in this. I think it's probably one of the greatest dysfunctional families of all time, to tell you the truth. King David is one of the most well-known figures in all of human history. He's got his own statue in Italy, goodness gracious, so who doesn't, as a matter of fact, now that I think about it. But this is incredible dysfunction that I think goes all the way back to his own childhood, where he's left alone as a child in the field. He's kind of abandoned by his family. When Samuel comes looking for the next king of Israel to anoint, the father doesn't even bring David to the party to get the anoint. Samuel's like, "Don't you have another son?" Because he keeps passing over one after another. Yeah. So obviously there was neglect. There was this huge neglect issue. And then in his own family parenting model, David is not a really good dad. And it's a guy who I wanted for so long to emulate in so many ways. And the more I know about David, the less I really want to be like him. I want that heart, right? That heart for God.
What does that mean when David has a heart for God?
That's a great question, because really good question, because it's this incredible heart for God that God keeps mentioning over and over again.
Yeah.
But it gives him like a free rein to do some pretty, gnarly stuff. I mean, the Bathsheba incident, obviously, he murders someone, steals the guy's wife. And then, God, it's interesting because David repents. And I believe it's in the Samuel passage. I think the very next sentence in the passage, and I don't have it, I'll look it up in a minute, says, when Nathan's speaking, well, God says that you will not die because of this sin. So there's like an immediate repentance. And this is something we see with God, when people have a true repentance. And I think that's the heart thing, because David was like a true repentance guy.
He's a screw up, but then he would.
Yeah. Yeah. I think two
failings.
Major failings. And none of them happened until he became king.
Yeah.
Which is all of his worst moments were once he got the thing that he always, well, maybe he didn't always want it, because he never really said he wanted. There's no Psalms where it's like, "I can't wait till I be king." Which is one of the points that I brought up in this series. We've been going through the David series for about a year and a half now, in episodically. So we've been going.
Remind me his two failings, Bathsheba and
The taking of the census were the two major failings. Is when he, had Israel count the number, and which is something you were in the law told not to do. Hmm. That was a faith thing. And even Joab comes up to him, and Joab's an interesting character, a huge character, huge nationalist, but not really sure if he was a David guy, but he was very loyal to David, but I think it was more of a Zionist nationalist because of that. So he takes that census, and God gives him three choices for discipline, and which we're speaking about today, this whole idea of discipline and the family model and healing families. And I think over the next 6 weeks, we're going to be jumping in to this, because we really want the podcast to be about, you know, emotive dealings in the family, and then really practical. We want to have practical tools for you and your family that you can, you know, jump into. But yeah, God gives him three possibilities. So you choose your discipline. You ever do that with your kids? You give them the, you know, options of of discipline.
That's my dad did that. You have a choice. You can either stop doing what you're doing and join us, or you can sit by yourself in the other room and continue to.
Well, no, I had, mine was like, okay, you can sit me in your room, or you can take 2 weeks of no phone, or you can, you know, that kind of thing. And God gives him, he basically says you can flee from your enemies for like a month or something like that. I forgot the exact day, the time. And then he says, or the angel of the Lord can come visit you. Or the other one, there would be a famine for like 3 years or something like that. And so David chooses the angel of the Lord because he goes, at least God has mercy. And that ends up what happened. God actually stops the punishment partway through, which is an interesting thing in regard to discipline too, because my mom rarely followed through with a punishment for me. Rarely ever. She, you know, I kind of knew I'd get off at some point. And so you hear, you see God doing it. With the cross, you see God doing it. I mean, which is interesting. We can get into that because God obviously foregoes the discipline with grace and mercy. And where do we bring in grace and mercy? Where do you need to set up proper boundaries and make all these things work? So if you haven't read the story of 1 Samuel in chapters, 2 Samuel, excuse me, chapters 12 through 18 would be a great, you know, prescription for you to read about this family that's gone wrong. And this discipline that God gave him, he says to David that the sword, or Nathan actually says to him in chapter 12 of 2 Samuel, the sword will never depart from your family. You don't want that, right?
No, not so much.
And even if you see, God and working in Israel, and if you continue to see the family line of David, the sword has not departed from Israel. There's been like, you know, seasons of this. Now, there was a season of peace with Solomon, but the sword did not depart. That's a pretty harsh punishment, you know. And so God gives this you know, idea that would happen in chapter 12. And then in chapter 13, immediately, it starts now after some time, which is like 20 years. It takes 20 years. But I think the author is trying to highlight consequences for sin. And there are consequences, and I think there needs to be consequences, and taking responsibility for those things. That's one thing David was always good at. He always took personal responsibility for his sin. And so we see Absalom come up into the story, and he is this son who's really good looking. He's amazing. But we know that David had never given him a word of correction. If you look in the scripture, or at least, well, not try to kill him, but try to take the kingdom by force. That was Adonijah. So this seems to be a concurrent theme in his family. It says, now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put him forward and said, I will be king. So he got his chariots and horses and ran with 50 men to run ahead of him. His father, now verse 6, this is the one. His father had never rebuked him by asking, why do you behave as you do? And he was also very handsome and was next born after Absalom. So this was kind of a concurrent theme. That's a pretty simple question to ask. I mean, it's not even asking him, like, dude, what's wrong? You know what I mean? Or like, or even a word of correction, like, don't do this. He never even asked him, like, why do you behave as you do? Which shows that there was discipline, there was just free reign. You know, Chris, as a marriage and family therapist, you know, when you see a home that has a weak parenting model, or, you know, a father that never disciplines, or a mother that never disciplines, or the mother that always comes in and lets the kid off. I mean, that was kind of our thing. My dad was an over-disciplined guy.
Yeah.
My mom would let me off. Rarely was there a punishment that was fulfilled. Kids must love it when there's no discipline.
I think in the moment they love it, but without discipline, I mean, discipline is love. You know, God is both just and loving, and
that's a great point. The discipline is a form of love.
Yeah. Well, and it's hard. Like, you think of Absalom to not have your father say, "Hey, what's up? Why are you doing this stuff? What's going on with you? Why would you be acting out this way?" A child internalizes that as, my dad just doesn't care about me. He doesn't love me in some way. And I speak with a lot of adults who kind of reflecting on their childhood, it's easier to make sense of. My dad was an alcoholic, or he was abusive. He was just really rough with us, or he was, you know, he was always critical of me. It's easier to make sense of those things than it is to, it's really challenging to say my dad just wasn't there.
Absentee.
Yeah, just neglecting.
Well, that's a form of, that's an orphan spirit. That's a form of orphan.
Yeah, and you're just left alone to figure it out, at least with, if a parent's involved and they show some concern for you. And so, the Absaloms of this world are just kind of left to figure it out. And it's a really painful place to be.
The Davids of this world, because he was left to figure it out on his own.
Which is interesting.
Well, and the thing that was so interesting about David is when he was alone figuring it out, he had something in his heart that it talks about in Romans. It says that people who don't hear the gospel will have the law of God written on their heart. And if they follow that law, that will become a law unto itself, and they will be judged according to how they follow it. So they can be saved or unsaved because of how they follow the Ten Commandments that basically is written on their heart. Something about David allowed him to want to be righteous in that place of neglect, but he just didn't have the tools to, you know, model that. Or,
and it's interesting to look back on, I mean, biblical times, and I mean, they
weren't hugging it out.
No, not really. and to see the generational stuff played out, you know, we have all these things. Whenever I talk to people about their story growing up, they're like, well, my dad was this or this or this, but you should see my grandpa. My grandpa was, so my dad did pretty good.
You know? Right.
And we kind of hold it up, and I didn't have it as bad as he had it, so it makes sense, and we kind of neglect or push our own stuff aside and how it hurt us. But it's really painful to not have your parent show interest in you. And that question is still a question that we should be asking. Why do you behave as you do? Why are you... what's going on inside of you? What's happening?
Right. It is a form of love and care and connection.
Which is super powerful for a child to have their parent show interest in them and say, hey, what's going on with you?
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. It's funny. I was walking out. I mentioned this in the sermon. I was walking out of UTC, and I was walking into the food court, and I saw this kid come flying out. He's like 4 years old. And the dad was like 8 feet behind him, like kind of running behind him. And then the mom was running behind the dad. And I heard the dads say, hey, don't you say that. And the kid turned around and says, don't you say that. And the dad said, I'm not saying that. And I thought, wrong answer.
Yeah. There you go. Defend yourself.
Right. And then he like chased the kid, and they're having this back and forth. And I thought, really? Like, that's, you know, and then, you know, the same weekend I'm talking about this, I was at a coffee house, and there was a parent letting their kids just run, you know, bat crazy around the coffee house. And then the one kid was at the table singing all the themes from The Greatest Showman, like full voice.
There you go.
And dude, it's really hard not to give unsolicited advice.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to, yeah.
Like, I tend to think of that kid when they're 16. I think this plays out. So, yeah.
And and we're good at pointing that out in other people. You know,
I'm the best dad of ever those kids.
My kids don't do that. But, I think you cannot go wrong by leaning in and being involved as a parent.
Right.
And by just showing interest. I think some people are like, I don't know what to say. You know, I don't know how to do this stuff. But it's just showing up and being there is half the battle with our kids.
Yeah, discipline, I really like that. I love the conversation as part of discipline. Discipline without a conversation, I have found, tends to leave a void, so to speak.
Like,
hey, you did this. This is the consequence. No conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get much conversation. I got the backhand. My dad had the German backhand that I would get, and I was there was definitely I feared my father. I didn't think he was going to kill me.
Yeah.
You know, but I definitely had a fear. You know, your dad was kind of a huggy bear, as I, you know.
Well, if you weren't his child, well, my dad was. He was in the Air Force for 20 some years, and it was definitely disciplined. I had that same fear. There's a question for you. Should a child fear their parent? Is there?
Well, are we talking about, you know, there's that biblical fear that it talks about. It's like a great honor and respect So if we're going to use the word fear, meaning honor and respect, and know that, like, because part of that fear, look, part of that fear is what makes me feel safe. Meaning, I feared my dad a little bit, but I knew if we were somewhere and push came to shove and someone came to, you know, attack us or whatever, or you know, my, yeah. I was under, you know, hey, I'd stand behind him. He'd be like, hey, I got this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'd be under his wing.
Yeah, you can lean into that.
You can lean into that. You can trust it. My father was not abusive. He was not abusive. He was absentee some. But he was not abusive. And so, but I did fear him because he had alcohol in the home as well, which will, you know, I said this last week, I want to keep saying it because it came up in a conversation with somebody. Somebody said, well, should I stop, you know, drinking or whatever? And I said, you know, alcohol can be a companion, but I said, it's never going to be your friend. And we need to realize that alcohol is never your friend and it always wants more. It'll take as much as you want to give it up to your life. Alcohol for us really affected the discipline model in the home. You know, if it was early on in the drink, my dad was a functional alcoholic, very successful. Never got DUI, never, he probably should have gotten a DUI, never got DUI, never got any of that, you know, stuff, never gotten bar fights, you know what I mean? But he just started going home earlier and earlier. You know, by the time I was 15 before he passed away, he was off work by 1:32 and back home drinking, painting, you know. So, but he'd get up at 5 or 6. But nonetheless, if it was early in the drink, then there was more leeway. There was more, you know, he was enjoying himself. But he got more upset, more impatient the more he drank. And then I knew to kind of keep my distance. Because if you were within hand reach or something, I just learned to be silent.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I, kids tend to understand the system they're in, don't they?
Intuitively, yeah. And in an alcoholic family, there's definitely rules for engagement. You know, you don't talk, you don't feel, you don't share outside the home. Those are very common.
Right, things. The pride, the secrecy.
Yeah, and so, and discipline. What was discipline like for you with your dad? Was it inconsistent and scary?
Well, my parents are divorced, so when my mom would have problems with me at school, she'd call in dad, and he would write me I have a 5-page letter he wrote me called the with pictures he drew. It said the stairway to success, and it was like this logical written out, like if you do this you get this, and if you do that you this will happen, and you want to climb the stairs, and it was like that thing.
Okay.
So he would bring me in for a little, he wasn't a great conversationalist, so she would bring me in and he would talk to me on occasion, like at 10 in the morning. These are my 10 in the morning, I haven't drank yet. Okay. And then try to give a course correction, which I think would have been more valuable if I would have seen it consistently, not just when, you know, when you're divorced, you're living with one parent, the other parent, my dad had a, you know, girlfriend at the time, you know, or multiple girlfriends or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But if I was with him, like one time, this is funny, we were there and my dad said, don't be a smart ass. And I turned around and made it look like my butt was talking and said, E equals MC squared.
There you go. That gets points.
That didn't go great. That was the backhand to the back of the head. There was like these flare-ups.
And what's the message, the backhand to the back of the head, that you received? I mean, what's the...
Stay further away.
Stay out of arm's reach.
Stay out of arm's reach.
Imagine your dad had long arms.
It was never more than one. Although my dad did hit me once in front of my mom in the back of the head. It was like a swinging backhand, and it was never full strength, but it was solid.
Yeah.
And this is when they were still together. I remember when I was 3, my mom said, "You ever do that again, I'm leaving you."
Oh wow.
So
you were 3. That's really young.
I remember.
To remember something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you get a backhand at 3 years old, the back of the head. You remember that, you know, or you won't remember it. But it may. I think it was a sporadic. There was no consistency to the discipline.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you, I don't know. I'm just thinking about it right now. What about people don't have a lot of a plan. Discipline usually tends to, like, whatever I'm feeling at the moment. What about having a plan for discipline in your family model?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing. It's for kids, The discipline, I think Charles Swindoll in one of his books wrote years ago on, it's like the fence at the playground. And they've actually done studies where they take down the fence on a playground where kids are playing all the way to the edge, and then they take the fence down and everybody, all the kids stay into the center of the playground, and then they put the fences back up and they go out to the edges again, and they feel, because there's a feeling of safety that I know where the boundaries are. I know where I'm allowed to go. And I think it's the same with kids. Inconsistency, it's
unsafe.
Well, that ambiguity, I mean, in anything, ambiguity breeds anxiety, that it's going to bring up this, like, how do I respond to this? I don't know if I'm going to get partially drunk dad or
absolutely. Matter of fact, not so much anymore. But until I was about 45, 50 now, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but I would walk into a room and I wouldn't feel comfortable in my own skin until I kind of sense what was going on. Yeah, I had to warm up into the conversations. I know
you become hypervigilant reading the room all the time.
Yeah, and some people have, you know, abuse backgrounds, which I didn't have abuse background. You know, having a disciplinarian father with it, you know, I probably got 10 backhands in my life.
Yeah.
I remembered them. You know, so having that is not an abuse. You know, my I know people that were beat. Those people walk into a room, they look for the exits. I know some people, they walk into a room and they have to know where the exits are.
Yeah.
But you know, having a plan is something. Matter of fact, we don't even really have a plan. We just try to have, we set boundaries on our discipline.
Well, and I don't think you necessarily have to have, if A happens, B happens. Because you're always kind of
in the moment
renegotiating some of those things, but you need to know where you're headed as a couple or as a single parent. You need to know, this is kind of the model.
Well, single parent would be gnarly. That'd be really hard to discipline.
Yeah, and it's hard, even as a, like you talked about, a divorced couple trying to parent children together. And
Knew I could play dad this way. I'm dad against mom, and I learned all those manipulation skills,
which is a whole different set of inconsistency, you know.
Right. If my dad pushed it too far, I'd go call mom from the payphone at the Bahia, which is a hotel in Mission Bay. We'd walk over to the Bahia and I'd call mom and complain, and then she'd call dad, and I knew I could get picked up earlier if I wanted to.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he'd be, why, you know, why'd you call your mom? You know.
Yeah. And a lot of that stuff the parents have to push through, and even if they don't like each other, get along enough to be consistent with the kids. Because there's studies show that kids that if the parents can get along, the kids can rest again. They can kind of be at peace if they
absolutely,
even if they hate each other, but they can get along and say, I respect you as the parent of my child, and I'll give you that respect. Then the children can say, okay, life is okay. Kids have a real hard time with allegiances and with...
Well, they're not supposed to be doing that. They're supposed to be playing with their toys.
Yeah. And so I think there's not a perfect way to do it, and there's not a perfect parenting style as far as plan goes, but there's the term good enough parenting, you know, that I like. You're just good enough. You know, you show up, you act out of love. When you don't act out of love, you apologize for those things and own it. That's a huge thing that some of the redemptive parts of David are that he's like, oh gosh, I blew it, and he comes back to it. You know?
Right.
And that, although my dad was rough, or, you know, I remember in junior high, I didn't want to, you know, I was failing eighth grade, junior high, and I remember him pinning me to the bed and saying, you will study and you will, and he overstepped, where I was terrified of him. But next morning, he got up early, came to my room, talked to me, hey, I'm so sorry for the way you know, and there's those repairs that if you can repair things and.
Yeah, I'm trying. It's funny. We had an incident yesterday. I won't go into what it was, but.
In your family?
Yeah. With one of my kids. And, you know, I had a season where everything went to DEFCON 4. You know what I mean? There was an early season where if I was upset, it always had to be. I've never been a rage guy, but I know there's like a landing spot on the emotional scale, and I always just went to that spot with no gradation in between. And then a lot of times it ends up messing up the discipline. And I found this became a pattern for a while where my kid would be able to come back to me or Carrie would come to me and say, hey, I agree that that was a problem, but the way you dealt with... And then all of a sudden, it's like, it's not about the issue anymore.
Yeah.
It's about how you dealt with the issue. Yeah. And I felt like for a while, it was just undercutting me so many times. So yeah. Yesterday was probably one of the times where I had the most success because... It was a safety issue. Something happened that it was a super big safety issue. And when it comes to safety, like for instance, one of the reasons we would spank would be because my kids love to shove things in the electrical socket. So
who doesn't?
Right, right. So for me, a spank on the bum, you know, is better than electrocuting yourself to death.
Yeah, same with running in the streets.
And yeah, or jumping in the pool. I mean, there's some adequate, you know, it was always, you know, correct. But yesterday there was a safety issue. And it's almost like when I find out what happened, like I came in, kid brought something up that had happened, and it's almost like there's a train wreck in my head. I feel like a... Like it's like I hit a wall and then I immediately want to go and I stop because I thought I don't want this to invalidate the discipline, all right, and I don't want to invalidate the moment. You see this in like politics a lot. Like something happens and then it's like, well, let's talk about what happened and why it happened and because of something else somebody else did, and it's blame shifting and all this crud. So I said, hey, I don't want this to become about how I reacted to it. I actually said that, and I said, I want you to know that I'm very calm. I'm not yelling, and I'm not a yeller anyways, but raise your voice or the tone. I get told a tone. So I said, I think I have a really good tone right now. And I said, I want you to know I'm very angry about this and this needs to be dealt with. And we're going to have a conversation with about it. And, that was wrong what you did. And we'll talk about it later. Thank you.
Those are the worst.
Those are the worst, right? But I'm just so tired of having an out to take away from what actually we need to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the cool thing is we get to evolve as parents and realize what we're doing wrong or what our triggers are and how we get,
right.
You know, and apologizing, taking ownership for it. And I mean, that sounds like a much more powerful thing than yelling. And then they can discount you because you're a jerk.
Dad's just a jerk.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then, and mom feels like you overstepped and she can side with kid a little bit or whatever happened. I don't know what happens in your family. But often we get polarized.
Yeah, that idea of being, you know, polarized or into one style. I do like having a pause button, like the ability to have a pause and really just to know when something happens that we need to pause and to let you can build that in. That's something we can build in.
And it's actually really effective. You know, what you just said to your daughter of saying, or your child of saying, hey, we're going to talk about this later is okay. When you, if I know I'm flooded with all these emotions and these chemicals that, you know, I'm angry about something, it's probably not the best time to deal with it. I just got a text from somebody the other day and I'm like, this is not their best self, you know, that they should have waited to send me this because it actually undermines my respect for them in the work that I do with them. And so it's when you can pause and say, I'll send this later, or let's talk about this at a different time, or, hey, you know that this was it overstepped or incorrect in your behavior. Think about a consequence for that. That was the worst thing that my dad did. He's like, I don't know what we'll do about this. Why don't you think about how we should deal with this?
Yeah, I think, one, allowing your kids to have a compass and to know what is right and what is wrong. And it's really hard to discipline kids from things that you're doing yourself or that are in the family model, or knowing that this is not allowed and we know that this is not allowed. And then really letting them know where we are on the playing field. This is one of the things my wife and I go back and forth about, because sometimes I'll say, you know, I just feel like with this particular kid or whatever, there's just the rules don't apply for me sometimes on these certain situations. And she will come back to me and say, well, maybe you haven't made it clear where the rules are. My wife tends to come, and I don't know if this is true collectively for women. I know men and women are built differently, and I know that there are women who are very authoritarian, and I know there are men that are very passive. So it's not true individually, but I think as a collective, they're finding with studies in Sweden with women that are choosing to go into nursing, like a huge percentage of women, and they're further ahead in regard to, you know, the Scandinavian countries in regard to gender equality than anywhere in the world. Mm. And they're finding that, you know, I forgot the exact number. You can just Google it. But the exact, you know, the amount of men are, you know, are choosing engineering, women are choosing nursing, health sciences. There are some things that we're finding in even the most gender equal areas in the world that they're, as a collective, women act a certain way. And I'm not going to let go of those gender differences. But I am finding that my wife tends to have a more nurturing approach to discipline. And I would say women as a whole have a more nurturing approach to discipline collectively through different cultures, not just, you know, this is just a cultural construct. What have you found, and have you found that to be true as are, you know, you're experiencing women and as a discipline?
As far as gender roles and how those play out as in discipline?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I think through my gender role every time I do, you know.
Well, I think there's, regardless if you have to be, I'll go back a little bit, because I don't necessarily want to speak on gender roles and parenting, because I think the single parent can be both, they can offer what needs to the kid needs to have.
Absolutely.
But the I would say it's really hard to discipline somebody when you're not disciplined in your own daily life. That I realize when I was a younger man, I did not provide. I had kids when I was a little older, but I wouldn't have provided the structure for the kids as they need. I wouldn't show up because I'm trying to get some of the holes filled in my own life, and so it's more about me than it is about creating. And when I could become disciplined in my own life, then I can create a structure of discipline for everybody else. And I think it's really, again, difficult for a child to look at their parent and say, well, why should I do this? You don't even do this.
You know,
the whole idea of do as I say, not as I do is really challenging. And so I think it's when we have good conversations, to be like, man, it's when I blow it from time to time, and I intentionally take the time that I take my children to school to kind of process their lives and my life. And
really good to have those areas in your life where you know that those are your sacred times. For us, we pray as we drive a certain stretch of road all the time.
Yeah.
To have those little, you know, geographical ties where you have something of meaning tied to that, which is a really, that's a good tool. I want to go back.
Go ahead.
Something else. One of the things you said about, and I don't think you meant to say it this way, but this is what I got from it, is, you know, not letting the discipline be about you. Whereas, and what I mean by that is I think my father felt like he didn't want me to embarrass him.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
this, I fall into that in that I value social niceties quite a bit.
Right.
So I realize, I don't want my kids to act a certain way because it reflects on me. And
right.
I remember that. I remember my dad yelling at me for going to church. I had Vans with a hole in the top because where my toe wore through.
Yeah.
Just,
you know, cool.
So cool back then. But he did not like it because it reflected on him. He was an associate pastor and all that in the church. And so there is, you have to tune into that stuff. You know, what is it about me? Even I get caught up in my own anger, you know, that's
what I'm talking about. Yeah.
It just, and something gets triggered, especially like something where somebody's possibly going to get hurt, you know, it freaks me out a little bit and I give full vent to my anger. Those are times when I'm left on the other end of it saying, man, I wish I would.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. There's a proverb, it's Proverbs 29:11, that says, a fool gives full vent to their rage, but the wise bring calm in the end. If some people are ragers.
Yeah, yeah, and oblivious to it. That's where you do the damage. I think if you realize, oh, gosh, you know, I get the, whatever you call it, dumb chills when you think back on something.
Yeah.
You can repair, those are repairable, but you have to be aware of it. You know, there's so much damage that gets done by just me being mad about something all the time.
The one of the things that I think is really interesting is the English Standard Version, which is my really become, besides the Holman Christian Standard Bible, my favorite version. Mm. One of the things I like about the ESV is that they're no longer updating it. Mm. They're like, hey, the scripture is spoken, and we're not going to, like, the new NIV is updating things. So they're changing, iron sharpens iron, like, you know, one man sharpens another. They've changed that to two friends or to a man or woman. And they've taken actually where the author actually intended it to mean, one gender, and they're making it gender inclusive, which is a problem in my opinion. I don't want to have the Proverbs 31 person. I want the Proverbs 31 woman. It was written to women by a woman.
Yeah.
They think Bathsheba. Nonetheless, all that to say, the fool in the English Standard Version gives full vent to his spirit, which I really like that translation because discipline and the discipline it really needs to come from this. It comes from the spirit. It can really, obviously led by the Holy Spirit. But what I think they're saying here is what is in your spirit, what is binding your spirit, what is loosed in your spirit, whether it be joy, peace, hope, redemption, comes out from that inner place. And the thing, from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. But the thing I love about God is punishment is always superseded, are meant to, or discipline is always meant to lead to repentance and reconciliation, redemption.
Yeah.
Repentance, reconciliation, redemption, three R's, you know, and those are three R's we can really work with as parents is like immediately starting from a place of pause. And then the next place, reconciliation, redemption, reconciliation, repentance, not in that order, but knowing those three R's in the discipline model with a pause at the beginning or rest, you could have four R's, throw in rest. The four R's, I could write a book.
You should.
The four R's of parenting.
You got four chapters right there.
What do you think about that? That disciplining from a place of the spirit.
Huh. Yeah, which is, and you think of God.
As opposed to strategy and tactics.
And you think of God as the parent, the good parent, the model for parenting.
Good father.
That it's not about him, that discipline is about our growth and our learning, to teach us, direct us, that guide us. That there's the passage that says, it's quoted as spare the rod, spoil the child. In Proverbs 13:24, it says, I have it right here. It says, those who spare the rod hate their children, but the one who loves their child disciplines them diligently. And I'll read that again. Those who spare the rod hate their children, but the one who loves their child disciplines them diligently. That the rod, years ago I heard a sermon on it, as far as a shepherd's rod.
Yeah.
It's the same word in Psalm 23 as your rod and staff, they comfort me.
Yeah.
And that there's that shepherd's crook at the top,
yeah.
and the shepherd's not out there beating his sheep all the time. That's his livelihood.
Right.
So it's not like he's whacking him with a stick.
I heard it was more of a poke. It's more of a boom.
It's more,
but not like whacking it over the back and with a full swing. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, and I haven't even been around sheep that much. I've been around them a little
bit. I have,
bit.
As a matter of fact.
There you go.
Yeah.
You shepherding?
No, I spent some time in Scotland, and I've actually gone on trips actually to view and watch sheep for the purpose of learning how to shepherd.
Yeah, and sheep aren't that smart. They're not the smartest.
No,
of animals.
But they're conditioned. Yes. And they're yeah.
But I like.
They're an agrarian wise.
It's like old man strength.
Yeah, it's like old man strong.
But I love the idea of that rod. I think we use that as an excuse to kind of discipline and which isn't to spank or to, but I like the idea of.
I was a spanker.
Yeah, and I haven't spanked a child. I have.
Really, ever? You afraid they're going to come take him away from you?
No. Well, no, not actually. But it's not necessarily useful all the time.
It's not. Well, I don't think you have to do it. I just, I mentioned yesterday that we had Mr. Spanky. It's a rubber spatula. Each kid got it less than 10 times in their entire childhood. It didn't start until they were probably out of preschool and like kindergarten, and it would be one swat to the bum, you know, and that was it with a, and it was like, yeah, it was nothing, you know, and, yeah. but to them, they were terrified of it. And it also separated me. I never used my hand.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and then they hated Mr. Spanky, but yeah. They didn't hate me.
Yeah. Well, and I think
Mr. Spanky, I put his name on it.
And I think I look back, and I've spanked my kids before, and but I look back and I'm like, was there other ways? Because
right.
I don't, you use the word terrified, and I don't know if I ever wanted my kids to be terrified of anything. I want them to respect it, to get the point, and not, so if there's another way, and it scares me, honestly, to put something out. I think a lot of people have moved away from spanking because people do it out of anger, people do it, and it's not about their kids' discipline, it's about their own, I want to control this child, which is a different thing. And so, and I'm not...
No. What you're bringing up is, you know, obviously, you know, we, this is a problem with our culture. You cannot have a healthy form of physical discipline, whether it be a spank or a Mr. Spanky, without the fear that the courts are going to come take your children.
Yeah.
Which...
Well, and I... Partially, I'm not talking about that as much as... Is there other ways? Because if all you have in your toolbox is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail.
Absolutely,
and
bro.
So there's a whole plethora of ways that people can get by. And so this, I like the idea of just generally this verse being, it's about correcting the sheep. It's about bringing them into right relationship. That shepherd's crook is actually pulling right. them back in, and it's. And I feel like the Spirit of God is for His people, too.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah. And so, I mean, we're talking a little bit about corporal punishment. Is that right?
Yeah.
I always think that's killing somebody. That's not. That's
no, it's a form of discipline.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I counseled with a person once, and they said their father would do, if he was upset, he would do 2 weeks and not speak to them.
Ouch.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Courts aren't coming to you for that.
No.
And it's way more problematic than one swat to the bum with Mr. Spanky.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think how do you show your child that you love and care about them? And because discipline is, I love and care for you, and you can't run in the road, honey. You can't stick that in there because you're going to die. And
right.
And some children, you got to correct them in different ways than you do... the conversation doesn't always just work.
Well, and that was true. You know, I had a friend who, you know, they had to find a different way. And it's true. It's different for every parent. For us, that worked, you know. And I don't, you know, I think by the time they were eight, there was like a five-year window where Mr. Spanky was available. But. Well,
and whether you spank or not, you have to evolve as a parent. You
absolutely.
Can't be spanking a 14-year-old, or you can't be even speaking to them in the same way because they're gonna. You have to have those conversations in a whole different way that are guiding them. You're a coach at that age.
It's funny that you said that because I used to, you know, when my daughter was three, I'd crawl in and we'd snuggle and cuddle and the whole thing. Well, yeah. You know, once they hit puberty, I'm not doing that anymore. You know what I mean? That just starts to get a little bit awkward. But I wanted to keep that physical contact because I had another person I counseled with who said, you know, as soon as they hit puberty, their dad just stopped touching them at all. They didn't know how to have physical contact. So I went to the back rub model and the foot rub model. So I just wanted to keep that positive, fatherly physical contact. So I'd do the, you know, fingers would be like horses. I had like 10 different moves that were back rubbing that I'd do shiatsu, you know, and I'd have like, just different stuff, but they loved it, you know?
Yeah. And the message to them is, oh, my dad cares. He's involved intimately in my life.
Right. Right. Yeah. And appropriate physical touch.
Yeah.
And all those.
And modeling for what it means for a man to show interest in me. And,
right. And even, you know, the same thing with their mother, you know, just being, you know, appropriate physical touch with their mother, letting, you know, I remember, I, I don't remember. Maybe they did. I don't really remember ever my parents like touching each other when they were near us.
Yeah.
You know. So that was interesting, you know.
I think that's another piece is just how do you have to live your life in such a way that you realize they're always watching, you know, they're always just taking it in, whether they intuit, if it looks like they're looking at their phone, they're still watching how you treat your wife, how you treat your husband,
how you live your life, yeah. What you do, how you pray. It's interesting. Have you noticed, you know, kind of a different topic. Have you noticed as your kid, how old's your son?
14 and 5. I have a 5-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Wow. A big spread there.
Well, I have 4 others and 3 others in between.
Yeah. Have you noticed you kind of loosen up a little bit as your kid gets older?
Yeah, it's actually fun.
It is fun.
To be able to say, oh, what do you think about that choice? Or what do you, how
you're not as guarded with your language, perhaps, in certain ways, or conversation. Do you find yourself?
Yeah, it's funny. I've started to go back and look at old movies from the 80s with my son.
Right. I'm the same way.
And he's like, oh, he's giving me some sideways looks like there's some language in this, or it's not a. Yeah. And I'm like, well, he's.
Those movies are gnarly. That's surprising, those 80s. I know. Movies. You're like, they're really bad, dude.
You don't remember all that stuff, but yeah.
And 70s R-rated movies are like. Crazy, like R in the 70s. I don't know. I'm be careful. I'm pretty careful what I watch. But we were listening to Green Day was on my Spotify, and I was like, and my daughter's like, hey, this is really good. She's 12. She's like, I like this. I'm like, well, let's listen to the whole album.
Oh, forgot some of the backtracks.
Yeah, there's some of the stuff on there, but. And then yesterday, I'm like, hey, what are you doing? She's like, I'm just listening to Green Day.
Like, not appropriate. Like,
my bad.
Not appropriate.
I was telling my youth group in the 90s, like, don't listen to these guys. And I'm turning my daughter's Spotify. Hey, have you tried this playlist here? You know, alternative 90s?
Yeah.
No. Keep away from. We have the explicit thing on her deal, so she can't listen to that. But just that some of that content, you know. Do you think, Chris, the discipline model, we live in the age, obviously, they make a lot of this. The whole everyone gets... a trophy, no one is told you're wrong, do whatever you know. Do you think that's affecting some of these?
I think it's well intended because nobody wants to.
You said balanced.
Nobody wants. Well, it is.
You're I think, so balanced.
I think we think that, oh, I'm helping these people to feel like they've achieved something. But again, it takes away the meaning of it if you take away the achievement part of it.
Well, I don't know if it's the achievement thing. I don't think it's about achievement or participation. I think it's about them not feeling bad.
Well, that's where I think we over empathize with our children sometimes. I don't want my child to feel bad. I don't want them to feel any pain.
That's why I won't discipline. And back to this conversation is why I think we're removing discipline from the model.
And we have a lot of anxious parents. I sat in a small group with, really high-functioning, good Christian people that are like, I said this to my daughter or I said this to my son, and I don't know how they're, you know, I'm worried about them, and I just don't want them to feel this or look at me this way. And it's like, my dad didn't really care how I felt about him necessarily.
Well, absolutely.
He's like, he was living his life, and
we never had that conversation.
And so, but we, as parents, I think this generation that's, I mean, we're in our 40s. This generation that we're in is very much, we don't want our kids to feel anything bad. We don't want them to be anxious.
Well, yeah, and it
undermines us as parents. It undermines us from actually stepping up and letting our kids feel the pain of not winning, of not being popular, of not feeling good at something. And without failing, you don't learn. Without failing, you don't... get the high highs of actually performing and achieving. Anyways.
Yeah, no, it has that, what is it, in Romans, it says that, you know, basically perseverance develops character, character develops hope, and there's this whole road of, like, you know, if you persevere through difficult things, whether it be discipline, it's actually what leads you to hope, and we're living in a hopeless world right now.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons we're living in a hopeless world, not only because of all the brokenness and the broken hearts and the broken families and this model of things that happen, but it's because kids aren't persevering through things like discipline. You know what I mean? Or they're not being allowed, they're being rescued on a regular basis. And in the end, they're not being rescued from themselves, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, we do make these generalizations of the world. It's, I was just thinking of, there's a lot of people, though, like CrossFit is huge and all these things where people are challenging themselves and highly disciplined, finding these places. I think people are coming to the place where it's like, my world is a little chaotic and I need people that are disciplined around me. I mean, have you ever gone to CrossFit? Have you ever been around?
I've done different things, but not CrossFit.
I don't go to CrossFit, but
the shorts don't fit me.
There you go. But they're crazy. It's like their own little community, and they're super. I've gone to a couple because I had a kid that was in college and training to do that, and so he's like, hey, come. But it's highly disciplined, but highly encouraging at the same time. Like, oh, you can do this, but you got to do it because. And so there's that piece. When I think of parenting, good parenting is like, lean into the hard stuff, fail big, you know, push yourself, but I'm here with you. I've got your back. And when you fail, it's going to be okay. And we'll push on and do it again. When there's an environment that can both nurture and support, and challenge, that challenge and support where it gives a framework for it, but it's, I expect the best out of you. Not because I demand it. I mean, I think that's why the pendulum sweeps so much. It's like, it's all performance based from our parents. And so it's like, I'm never going to be that way. I'll be all feelings based or whatever. I think it's both, you know, you gotta love your kids, challenge them to be the best and support them to reach those goals. And there's a huge spectrum of how to do that. I don't think you have to do it one certain way. I don't know why I talked about CrossFit, but
Because people are wanting structure and discipline. That's what you were saying.
Yeah, and there's a hunger for it. There definitely is a hunger for it.
Yeah, I have found that if you're at church, that if you're going to have a successful program these days, the best thing to do is ask for a super high commitment. You know what I mean? Yeah, as opposed to like, hey, we're having a group. You can show up for 6 weeks and maybe show up in, if you want, and yeah, it's going to be great. We don't want to get in your way. Or if I say, hey, I got a, like, we have this one thing, it's a men's thing, it's 9 months long, and it's costs like $800, and you got to go, I mean, it's just all this commitment to get into it and be a part of it, but people feel like there's value in that and having that. And I think that the whole point for discipline in this conversation is the structure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, same thing with coaching. I remember reading a coaching book years ago that talked about if the coach says, hey, go down and touch the line and come back, and you don't do it, and he's just like, okay, whatever, and just kind of looking at his clipboard or whatever, it actually undermines the coach. We don't think that, but when we don't hold our children or the people that we're working with accountable to it, to a standard, say, you said to touch this line. That, I mean, the hardest teachers that did it with love or coaches that were in my life, I'm like, yeah, that guy pushed me to be my best. And when those people don't hold the child or the person accountable, it feels like you don't love me. It's back, you know, full circle to,
right,
you don't even care enough to hold me accountable to these things. And because we all know when we're giving our best or when we're, you know, doing the right thing or not. And discipline is part of that. It's just this course correction to say, hey, come back over here to where you should be. And that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of involvement in the life of the parent to the child, you know. It's not easy work.
You know where they're struggling with this discipline model is in the school districts.
Well, yeah, they've kind of put themselves in a bind where you can't, everything's got to be PC and
you can't correct the kids.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, it is a bit of a bind.
Yeah.
Did you have a standard growing up? I knew that we had this thing that was, I don't remember. I think my dad said something to the effect of like, you know, we're stat millers. There was this sense and I'm like, what does that mean? You know what I mean? Is, you know, not like we're, you know, just a sense of, you're better than that.
Kind of family pride.
Yeah, but it wasn't like we're better than anybody. It wasn't like you know, English gentry where you're ranking yourself in this. I just saw Downton Abbey, and the one guy says to the other guy, he says, you know, you're from a medium family of nobility that isn't even high up the chain. I'm from this one, and so what do you have? You know, it wasn't that ranking thing, but it was like, yeah, there was a family sense of duty. There was as much of a sense of duty as there was a sense of respect. My parents were very generous.
Yeah.
We helped multiple people gain citizenship that worked in our restaurants. We had many people come as illegal aliens and become citizens. And our chef we had for 50 years knocked on the door, ended up being the chef at a restaurant, just retired. For 50 years, you know, his name was Miguel. And so there was this sense of duty that actually, I don't think it did me bad, because I remember when I was doing drugs and I was in PB, and I remember one day I got up and I smoked pot and I was sitting there thinking, I thought, I don't even know who I am anymore, but I'm not who I know I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something powerful of calling people into their better self, calling you into your best self.
That's my favorite thing to do.
Of just saying, hey, I see this in you. I see, and not in a shaming way.
No.
But it's, hey, and I mean, it doesn't take much. If I see a person who's really good at something and invites me into it, or sees something in me and says, oh, you should, that can cast a vision for me of who I could be or what I could do, man, I'm jumping at that stuff, because we're just hungry for it, you know? And I think we don't always see that in ourselves and our children, especially, to cast a vision for who they could be.
Absolutely.
And to have a family vision of, hey, we set this, you know, we're Batemans or we're Statmillers or we're whoever, the Smiths. And this is the standard that we live by. That's calling you into something.
Yeah, and that model, obviously, of our own names, obviously those names will pass away in heaven, is obviously based on scripture, is based on a family in heaven, is based on our identity as adopted children of God.
And I think you don't, I mean, that can also be used as either we're better than that, or there can be some shaming in that, like don't, we're
well, that comes
we're
out of a lot of Asian culture. A lot of my Asian friends feel that sense that there's a big shame culture, like, you know, you don't, yeah, don't you know, not disrespect, dishonor the family,
yeah,
you know, and having to have that. So go ahead.
And again, I think that's, if there's love, if you can have a conversation about what that means, if it's not just either my way or the highway kind of a thing, like you live up to these standards, that's when we get into trouble, is, oh, you fell short of this, and
yeah,
and I'm disappointed in you. You know, those are motivators, but they're not good motivators. You know,
right.
It embitters the person, right, to live under that. But yeah.
So coming in for a landing, as a marriage and family therapist, in regard to, you know, maybe it's time to recalibrate your discipline model. I think we've come across some good things. What are some things that you would probably share as pivotal tools to help recalibrate? Because we can always recalibrate. We can always, you know, change. What are some things we want to look for in our parenting model? Or maybe just summing up some of the things we've said.
There's four R's. I think, I mean, that doing it out of love, doing it out of the best interest of them, I think just holding it up to the light and saying, my discipline, my reaction, my whatever's coming, is this out of love or is it out of my own? That's when I get into trouble, is it's out of my own anger or frustration. And then is discipline meant to guide, teach, direct? Is it meant to help them to correct in a way that's going to help them to be a better person, to grow from it? Am I letting them feel the pain of the consequences of their own actions?
I like what you said, bringing it into the light. And letting all this...
Hold it up to the light.
Hold it up to the light. Yeah, hold it up to the light. Whatever the situation is, to cast a light on it, to discuss it, to bring it out into the open, not just immediately move to, you know, you shouldn't have done that, you know you shouldn't have done that, this is, you're horrible because of this, it's horrible, that was a horrible thing you did, that was a horrible thing you said, why do you act that way? All the shaming words.
Yeah.
Shaming, I think, moves us into the darkness. It moves people to recoil. And I think every time there's a discipline, there's an opportunity to strengthen the relationship. And I find relationships that my best relationships are ones that have gone through difficulty. You know, it's the ones where you've learned to trust somebody through. You've made a decision to continue. They might not be my closest relationships, but some of my best relationships are people I know I can trust. I actually have a lot of people I don't really want to go on a road trip with them. I don't think we would, you know, connect for long periods of time or enjoy the same things, but I highly trust them. And it's because
they've proved me, Adam.
No. We've gone on road trips.
I'd go on another road trip with you.
No, but there's just people I just really trust and connect with because of that, you know, making it through the discipline or what we learn through it or our rough patches. And I'm not a person that believes, you know, people say you only grow in the valleys. You know, I don't think that's true. I think you can grow when things are great.
And growth is a choice. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Choosing to grow is a choice. There's lots of opportunities to grow.
And I think that's one of the takeaways for me. It's like, how am I growing as a parent? How am I growing in this? As my child grows, I have to grow as a parent. What worked back then when my kids were 3, 4 no longer works. And so I have to evolve. I have to grow in this. And the fun thing, like you just said, the fun thing is that I get so much more out of the relationship when I invest in it. You know, it's those people that unconditionally have invested in me that they get as much out of it as I do. And when I invest in my kids in that way and am curious with them and on why they did something, I don't have to discipline everything. I can let them create self-discipline. You know, why'd you do that? You know, not to talk about his stuff, but he got bad grades a couple of years ago, and I'm like, man, how's that feel? You know, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't real happy about it, but he doesn't want to be in that place again. You know, how did you end up here? What did you do? You know, that question that you started with, why did you behave as you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just asking that question is very powerful, for kids to look back at themselves. Anyways.
No, that's good. My takeaway would be, like, get this huge paddle. And then I'm just,
you know, Mr. Spanky.
Mr. Spanky. And then, yeah, get it on a spring system with a calibration of 110. No, I really, I do like the, for me, I think the pause and the everything and that is the purpose of the discipline is reconciliation, redemption.
Yeah.
That's always the purpose of these things. And in the moment, I think if you're dealing with a really difficult child, a kid that's running away, a kid, you know what I mean? We're talking about pretty simplistic discipline models at the moment. We're talking about, I mean, we've been talking about.
Yeah, just generalities.
We're not talking about a kid, you know, bringing, like I did, drugs into the home or, you know, leaving in the middle of the night and coming back at 3 a.m. with some chick and crawling through the window. I mean, there's this craziness I was doing.
And part of that is how do you begin to have those conversations when before they have the ability to have a car and all that stuff to.
Right.
And so that you build a groundwork for having great conversations. What I want for my kids is for them to be able to come back to me and say, hey, this is what's going on, you know, that I have an open dialogue with them enough and they're not just afraid of me or feel shamed by me where they can talk to me. And that's touchy-feely, you know, I'm a counselor, but there's a piece of that is how do I want to be spoken to? How do I want to be?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's other forms of discipline, but it's how do you keep those open dialogues? Go ahead.
Yeah. And I've always believed that you're pretty much done parenting. And most of it is set by the time your kids are 10, and then after that, you're moving towards friendship, and relation. You know, they become more of a friend, Eventually, they're just another adult, and they realize, oh, you're my dad, but you're just another adult like me.
Yeah, and friend's a loaded word, but definitely much more of a coaching model where they come to you, and you're like, maybe you should.
Why is friend the loaded word?
Well. Because people are like, that's my best friend is a 12-year-old. It's kind of weird, you know. That I don't.
I think you
befriend your children, but they're not. It's not a.
It's not the same type of friendship. It's just like love. There's different nuance of it, you know. Different levels. The way I love my child is not the way I'm going to love my wife. The thing I share with my wife, I'm not going to share with my children. But But as a friendship, I realize sometimes when we didn't know what to do, this always worked for us. When we didn't know what to do with discipline and we felt like things were getting out of control, or there was a pattern happening, we tended just to take the kids away and go to the mountains or camping. Mm. We have a cabin up in Big Bear. We were blessed to have that. Her parents own it, and it would just be personal time. And I found that even on sometimes where instead of doing a discipline, I'd say there was more than once where I'm not going to discipline. I'm going to take you away, and we're going to go hang out.
Yeah,
and we would go away for a long 3-day weekend. We'd go away for a week. Yeah. If it was summertime, I would just take her up to the cabin. I'd work from the cabin. We'd hike and do things. And it was like all of a sudden things would get settled, because a lot of kids act out, sometimes out of self-will, but they act out because they're asking for something.
Well, and which is huge. It goes back to the beginning of this conversation of why do you behave the way you do? You're pursuing your children's heart. You're in that setting, it's creating a whole new setting where you can do that. You don't have the distractions of the world.
That's your book title, dude. Pursuing Your Children's Heart.
There
That's
you go.
So good.
But just that, there's something about that. If you're pursuing them and you want the best for them, you know, and that's pretty insightful to say, we just need to get out of here as a family so that we can reconnect, because there's in those points of disconnection as a family, again, there's anxiety in that. What do I do? And kids don't make great choices under that. None of us make great choices when we're anxious and disconnected. And so to be left alone in those situations is really painful. And so the more you can connect and be a resource to the kids, I mean, that's awesome stuff of actually getting out of here and camping or going for a hike where phones are off or whatever. All that mm-hmm. stuff is so invaluable nowadays.
Really, really good. Yeah. Well, it's been a good conversation. Do you have anything else?
No, that's it.
That was it. That's all your nuggets right there, dude.
All the smart things I have in my head.
Well, this is the F3 podcast. We're missing. We're down one of the F3. It's three. You know, I realize because it's faith, facts, and feelings, but there's also three of us, which is kind of cool.
So, do we each represent one of those?
We each represent one of those three. So, yeah,
we won't define who's who. So we were down.
We should get a fourth. We should get a frivolous and a fourth F. But
you like the alliteration R's and F's.
Yeah, it works. It works. It makes things simplistic. So hey, it's been a great conversation. If you have any questions about this, or you have any topics you want us to discuss, you can email me, adam@ljcfemail.org, or put something in the comment section here, wherever this is. And we will see you next week. Are you here next week?
Nope.
No, but it'll be me and Harry. There'll be the F2 doing the F3. All right, we'll talk to you later. God bless. Bye.